Imagine going to school for years, like really dedicating your life to becoming a healer.
Yeah.
You spend thousands of hours mastering all these clinical interventions and, complex trauma therapies.
Right, doing the real heavy lifting.
Exactly. Only to graduate and find out your biggest daily threat isn't actually client crisis.
Oh, not at all.
It's the Canada Revenue Agency.
It's terrifying, honestly.
It really is. Because if you're starting a solo private practice right now, and specifically if you're in a place like British Columbia, you aren't just a therapist anymore.
No, you wear a lot of hats.
Right. You are suddenly forced to be like a corporate bookkeeper, a privacy compliance officer, and a digital marketing specialist. And all of this happens before you even see your first client of the day.
Which is wild because the clinical training programs do a fantastic job teaching you how to sit in the room with someone who is suffering.
They really do.
But they do an abysmal job teaching you how to, well, pay your own rent while doing it.
Yeah, the actual business side.
Exactly. You step out into the professional world and you realize you just don't have a map for the business of therapy. Establishing a solo practice is entirely distinct from being a good clinician.
Totally different skill set.
If you want to survive and actually help people long term, I mean, you have to build a sustainable business engine that actively prevents your own burnout.
Okay, let's unpack this because that is exactly our mission for this deep dive.
Perfect.
We've gone through a massive stack of sources for you today. We're talking interviews with successful Canadian solo practitioners, legal documents, financial guidelines, personal notes, the works.
It's a lot of material to get through.
It is. But we're distilling all of it down to give you the ultimate beginner survival guide. We're looking specifically at British Columbia today.
Which has its own unique quirks.
Oh, definitely. We're breaking down the essential foundation you have to build, the liability traps that can literally ruin you, and the actual mechanics of getting paying clients in the door without, losing your mind.
Well, the most urgent thing to understand about British Columbia right out of the gate is the regulatory landscape.
Right.
Because unlike Ontario or Nova Scotia, which have these strict government-mandated regulatory colleges for
Yeah,
psychotherapists,
BC is different.
very different. British Columbia is considered an unregulated province for this specific profession. There is literally no provincial college of counseling therapists here.
Which means, practically speaking, anyone off the street can just hang a shingle, call themselves a therapist or a counselor, and start charging people to talk.
Pretty much.
It's essentially the Wild West out here. And for you, the listener, who actually has a master's degree and proper training, this creates a massive marketing and legitimacy problem.
It really does.
Because you have to actively prove you aren't just like a life coach with a nice Instagram account.
Exactly. Your professional legitimacy in BC is entirely in your own hands. The sources are absolutely unanimous on the first step here.
Getting certified.
Yes. You must become certified with the CCPA. That's the Canadian Counseling and Psychotherapy Association. Because you don't have a provincial college to join, the CCPA acts as your national vetting body.
Right, they check your credentials.
They do. They verify your master's degree, your practicum hours, your clinical supervision. Earning that Canadian Certified Counselor, or CCC designation, is what signals to the public and to insurance companies, honestly, that you're a vetted professional.
And it also unlocks the most critical shield you need, which is professional liability insurance.
Crucial.
Through the CCPA's partnered brokers, like BMS, you can secure comprehensive coverage for, I think around $500 to $1,000 a year.
That sounds about right.
And this isn't optional, guys. If a client ever files a grievance or a lawsuit claiming your therapy caused them harm, this insurance pays for your legal defense.
Practicing without it, especially in an unregulated province, is basically financial suicide.
Absolutely. So once you have your certification and your insurance sorted, you really have to establish your digital foundation.
Which is where people get distracted.
Yeah. A lot of new practitioners want to immediately start picking out website colors and designing logos, like the fun stuff.
The fun stuff, right. But the actual concrete of your business is your electronic medical record system, or EMR.
Now, I've heard some newer practitioners say they just want to keep things simple and cheap. Like, why can't I just use a standard password-protected Google Calendar to schedule clients and keep my session notes in a locked Word document on my laptop?
Oh, because of a massive piece of federal legislation called PIPEDA.
Right. The Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act.
That's the one. This law strictly governs how commercial businesses in Canada handle sensitive personal data, and medical and mental health records are the most heavily protected data class in the country.
So Google doesn't cut it.
Not out of the box, no. A standard Google Workspace or generic email provider is not PIPEDA compliant by default. And furthermore, you really have to consider data residency.
Yeah, actual physical server location.
Exactly. If you use a cheap, generic scheduling software that hosts its data on American servers, those records are suddenly subject to U.S. laws.
Which is a big deal.
A huge deal. Under U.S. laws like the Patriot Act, American government agencies can theoretically compel tech companies to hand over data stored on their servers without ever notifying you or your Canadian clients.
Wow.
Yeah. And as a practitioner in Canada, you are legally obligated to protect your clients' health information from that kind of foreign exposure.
So what's the fix?
The sources strongly recommend using a dedicated PIPEDA-compliant EMR that guarantees your data is hosted exclusively on Canadian servers. The JNAP is the most frequently cited example here.
Okay, JNAP.
It encrypts your clinical notes, automates your intake forms, processes payments, all while keeping you on the right side of federal privacy laws.
Wait, I want to pause on the payment processing side of things for a second. Because the financial advice and resources really surprised me.
Oh, the bank accounts?
Yeah, the absolute insistence on opening a dedicated business bank account from day one seems a bit intense.
I know it sounds like a lot.
Right, because if I'm, say, keeping my full-time agency job and just seeing two private clients on a Tuesday night to test the waters, setting up formal corporate bank accounts feels like administrative overkill.
It does feel that way.
Why can't I just have clients e-transfer my personal checking account?
Because mixing personal and business funds is how you trigger an absolute nightmare scenario in the event of a tax audit.
Okay, fair.
Imagine a Canada Revenue Agency auditor asking you to prove which of the 200 e-transfers in your personal account last year were like from your aunt for dinner and which were from clients.
Oh, that sounds awful.
If you can't cleanly separate them, they can just disallow your business deductions outright. But beyond the bookkeeping headache, there is a specific, massive tax mechanism tied directly to working in British Columbia.
Right. Because BC is unregulated, therapy isn't treated as a tax-exempt medical service.
Exactly. In regulated provinces, registered psychotherapists recently gained an exemption from charging sales tax. But the CRA views practitioners in unregulated provinces as standard commercial businesses.
Okay, so what does that actually mean for the therapist?
It means the moment your private practice crosses $30,000 in revenue over four consecutive calendar quarters, you cross the mandatory GST-HST threshold.
30 grand.
30 grand. You are legally required to register for a GST number, collect that tax from your clients on top of your hourly rate, and remit it to the government.
And if your client payments are just like flowing into the same account where you buy your groceries and pay your Netflix bill, the revenue gets totally muddied.
It gets lost.
You might cross that $30,000 threshold without even realizing it.
And the CRA does not care if it was an accident.
No, they don't. If they find out you should have been collecting GST for the last 2 years and you weren't, they don't go after your clients or the missing money.
No, they go after you.
You will owe those thousands of dollars out of your own pocket, plus penalties, plus interest.
It can ruin a small practice. A dedicated business account tracks every single dollar of revenue in isolation, so you know exactly when you hit that trigger.
Financial hygiene prevents financial panic.
Well said.
Which naturally brings us to the core advice for your personal finances. Keeping your day job. The sources stress this repeatedly.
They really do. When you first launch, you should have a steady income stream from a part-time or full-time job or a dedicated emergency fund that covers at least 3 to 6 months of your personal living expenses.
And this isn't just about paying your rent, right? It is actually a clinical boundary issue.
A huge one.
If your personal survival depends on securing the next three clients who call you, you are introducing a subtle but really dangerous desperation into the therapeutic relationship.
You start making compromises you wouldn't normally make.
Right. You might take on a couple seeking specialized trauma therapy that you are completely unqualified to provide, simply because you need their $200 fee to cover your car payment.
And financial desperation completely erodes clinical judgment. You might ignore red flags from a highly volatile client.
Or avoid pushing back on them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You might hesitate to challenge a client's harmful behavior because you're afraid they'll quit and take their revenue with them. Having a separate income stream builds a firewall between your financial survival and your client's clinical care.
So you only take on the cases you are genuinely equipped to handle.
Precisely.
That firewall concept is a great way to transition into the liability traps.
Oh, the traps.
We've laid the foundation. You're certified, you're insured, PIPEDA compliant, and you're keeping your day job. Now we need to look at the unintended legal exposures that trap new therapists.
Where do you want to start?
Let's start with the free consultation. Our sources highlight this as a massive error. But, you know, as a new therapist, your instinct is to be generous.
Sure, you want to help?
If a potential client wants to chat for 15 minutes to see if we're a good fit, offering that for free just feels like basic empathy. Why is this considered such a severe misstep?
What's fascinating here is that from a purely mechanical standpoint, giving away unstructured time is just a fast track to burnout.
Right.
You are giving away the exact product you sell, which is focused, empathetic attention for free multiple times a week.
But there's a deeper issue, too.
Yes. The hidden legal liability. When a client books a formal session, they first sign your informed consent documents. They read your practice policies, your cancellation fees, and crucially, they are briefed on your legal limits of confidentiality.
Right, the mandated reporting laws.
Exactly. Yeah. When you just hop on a casual free video call or a phone call with a stranger for a meet and greet, you usually haven't collected those signed forms.
You might not even have their full legal name.
Or a physical address or an emergency contact. Now imagine 5 minutes into this casual chat, this total stranger discloses active, imminent harm to a minor or severe suicidal intent.
Oh, man. You are legally mandated to report that, but you have no forms, no address to send emergency services to, and no documented consent explaining that you even have to break confidentiality.
You are completely paralyzed and legally exposed.
It's terrifying.
And it happens far more often than new therapists think. Clients in distress don't understand the boundaries of a consultation. They just start unloading.
So what's the actionable advice from the sources?
Automate your screening process. Use your EMR to require potential clients to fill out a secure, comprehensive intake form before they ever speak to you. Let the software do the heavy lifting of gathering emergency contacts and signed consent.
It protects your time and your license.
Exactly.
The theme here seems to be that good intentions can create massive unintended legal exposure. Which brings us to the marketing trap.
Ah, yes. The illusion of telehealth.
Right. Because you can jump on a secure video call from your living room in Vancouver, there's this huge temptation to run Facebook or Google ads targeting the entire country to fill your practice faster.
But the physical location of the therapist doesn't dictate the rules. The physical location of the client does.
Right.
Even though British Columbia is unregulated, if you set up a targeted ad campaign for individuals living in Toronto or Halifax, you are now operating in the jurisdiction of regulated provinces.
And if the College of Registered Psychotherapists of Ontario catches an unlicensed practitioner from BC advertising therapy services to Ontario residents, they don't care about BC's rules.
Not even a little bit. You are essentially practicing medicine without a license in their jurisdiction. They can and will issue cease and desist orders, and you can be slapped with staggering fines.
So you have to geofence your digital marketing.
Strongly geofence it. Restrict your ads and your digital footprint to BC residents or residents of other specific unregulated territories where you are explicitly legally cleared to operate.
Establishing these strict boundaries, whether it's geographic marketing, financial separation, or refusing free consults, it often feels super uncomfortable for new therapists.
Very uncomfortable.
And that discomfort frequently shows up in another major trap.
Oh.
The waitlist.
Oh, the waitlist.
I have to admit, the waitlist dynamic is so counterintuitive to me. In almost any other business, a waitlist is the ultimate badge of honor.
Sure.
If you walk past a restaurant and there's a line around the block, it signals prestige. It tells the market you are in high demand. If my practice is full, isn't keeping a waitlist just a smart business move to ensure my future schedule stays booked?
But therapy is not a restaurant.
Right.
Applying standard commercial ego metrics to a healing profession is dangerous. Think about the mechanism of seeking therapy from the client's perspective.
Okay.
Most people avoid therapy until their distress becomes completely unmanageable. When they finally muster the courage to search for a therapist and reach out, they are in acute, immediate pain.
They need an intervention now, not in 8 weeks.
Exactly. When you reply to that vulnerability by saying, "I have no room, but I'll put you on a list and maybe call you in 2 months," you are effectively keeping them on the hook.
Because they think they're set.
Right. Many clients will stop looking for other help because they feel they've secured a spot with you, even if that spot is months away. You are leaving them stranded in acute distress simply to pad your future calendar. It is a profound disservice to their well-being.
Wow. So the ethical move is to cut the ego out of the equation entirely.
Completely.
If your practice is full, clearly state on your website that you are not accepting new clients. When someone reaches out, reply within 24 hours with a warm referral.
Yes.
Hand them a list of 3 local peers who you know have immediate openings, or direct them to a directory.
The sources emphasize that this builds incredible goodwill within your professional community.
Oh, for sure.
Those peers you referred clients to, they will remember you when their own practices fill up.
Community over competition is basically a survival tactic.
It really is.
And that transitions perfectly into the mechanics of actually filling those empty chairs ethically. If you aren't running illegal out-of-province ads and you aren't hoarding waitlists, how do you build a steady stream of local clients?
The consensus in the materials is clear. Prioritize search engine optimization, or SEO, over paid advertising.
Why is that?
Because paid ads are like renting a digital billboard. They absolutely work, but the exact second your credit card stops paying Google or Meta, your visibility drops to 0.
You build no permanent equity.
Exactly. SEO, on the other hand, is like a digital savings account that earns compound interest. Writing highly targeted, high-quality blog posts on your website costs nothing but your time, and those posts stay there forever, slowly climbing the Google rankings.
The trick is understanding the mechanics of how your ideal client searches for help. You have to get into the mind of the person sitting on their couch at 2 in the morning, unable to sleep.
Right, what are they typing?
They aren't going to Google eclectic holistic therapeutic modalities for nervous system regulation.
No, they don't know the clinical jargon.
Right. They are typing in desperate, highly specific phrases. They are searching for anxiety therapist Vancouver, or counseling for tech burnout in BC, or how to stop panic attacks at work.
And if you write a dedicated article answering those exact questions using those specific phrases in your titles, Google's algorithm eventually recognizes your site as a localized authority.
So they basically send you clients.
For free. When someone nearby searches for that exact pain point, Google hands you a highly motivated client. It takes months to build that momentum, but once it starts, it becomes a self-sustaining referral engine.
But while you are waiting those 6 months for Google to notice your blog posts, you have to rely on a much older, much faster mechanism.
Networking.
Networking. Or, as our sources call it, the power of the coffee date.
It's a classic for a reason.
It is the most effective and cheapest marketing tool available. You identify other local practitioners, family doctors, chiropractors, massage therapists, or even other therapists whose practices are completely full, and you ask to take them out for a quick coffee.
And you pay for the coffee.
Yes, you pay. You are asking for their time, so you absorb the cost. The mechanism here is entirely about trust. When a family doctor has a patient crying in their examination room, that doctor doesn't want to tell the patient to just go look at a directory online. They want to hand that patient a physical business card and say, "I had coffee with this therapist last week. I trust them. Call this number."
Algorithms simply cannot replicate the conversion rate of a trusted personal recommendation.
No, they can't. And once that engine starts running, whether from SEO or coffee dates, you suddenly face a new problem: managing the influx of clients without losing control of your life.
A good problem to have, but still a problem.
Which brings us to a scheduling tactic from the sources that I found absolutely brilliant.
The secret sessions.
Here's where it gets really interesting. When you configure your online booking calendar in your EMR, the default instinct is to make all your available working hours public. Like if you want to work 20 hours a week, you put 20 open slots on the internet.
Which means the public dictates how your energy is spent.
Exactly. The secret session tactic changes that dynamic entirely. You intentionally withhold 2 or 3 time slots from your public-facing online booking page.
You keep them hidden.
Right. They're only visible to you on your master administrative calendar. Let's look at how this works mechanically. Imagine your public calendar is booked solid for the next 3 weeks. Suddenly, a long-term client of yours experiences a severe sudden crisis.
Like a death in the family or a major panic episode.
Right. They email you desperately needing a session. If your calendar was 100% public, you would either have to turn them away in their moment of need, or you would have to sacrifice your Saturday morning off to squeeze them in, leading to your own exhaustion.
But because you have those hidden secret sessions, you retain total control.
You do.
You can reply and say, "I have a private opening I can offer you this Thursday." It makes the client feel profoundly cared for because you accommodated their emergency.
And it protects your personal time because you are still working within your defined weekly hours.
Exactly. And if no one happens to have an emergency that late, you can simply open the slot to a new client at the last minute or use that block of time to write an SEO blog post.
Or just take a much-deserved break. It is masterful boundary management.
Boundaries really are the recurring theme of everything we've discussed today. The secret sessions, refusing free consults, keeping your day job, relying on SEO rather than frantic ad spending.
It's all connected.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, they are all mechanisms designed to combat the ultimate villain of solo private practice, isolation.
Oh, the isolation is real. The visceral reality of solo online practice is often sitting alone in your living room, staring at a laptop screen, absorbing heavy, traumatic stories for 6 hours a day.
And when the laptop closes, the silence in the room can be deafening.
Yeah, you don't have a break room. You don't have coworkers down the hall to debrief with after a particularly harrowing session. You absorb the impact completely alone.
This is why securing a clinical supervisor is not just an academic box to check so the CCPA will give you your certification.
Right.
It is a structural necessity for your own mental survival. You need a dedicated, confidential, external space to process the emotional weight of your caseload.
If you try to carry it all yourself, your clinical empathy will eventually curdle into resentment.
Exactly. The sources also emphasize the need for non-clinical community. You need peers who understand the specific, frankly, bizarre reality of being a therapist and a business owner.
So, like joining local wellness networking groups.
Or just setting up a monthly Zoom call with three other solo practitioners just to complain about the CRA, discuss marketing tactics, and vent. It's crucial. If you don't intentionally construct a community around your solo practice, the isolation will crush your joy for the work.
Okay, we have covered some serious terrain today. Let's do a quick wrap-up of the essential mechanisms for starting your BC practice.
Sounds good.
Start slow. Keep your day job to prevent financial desperation from infecting your clinical judgment. Secure your CCPA certification and liability insurance so you are legally legitimate.
Get that Canadian EMR.
Yes. Use a Canadian-hosted EMR like Jane to comply with PAYPITA. Open a separate business bank account immediately to track your revenue toward that $30,000 GST threshold.
Value your time.
Right. Value your limited time by ditching ego-driven waitlists and those risky free consults. Invest in long-tail SEO, buy local peers coffee, and actively build a community to process the weight of the work. You are stepping out of the role of a pure clinician and into the identity of a business owner.
It's a big shift.
It is. So what does this all mean? It means you have the ultimate power to design an infrastructure that serves your life, your energy, and your capacity to heal.
As we close, I want to leave you with a fascinating tension highlighted repeatedly in the source material regarding why so many therapists are fleeing to private practice in the first
It's a very real phenomenon.
place. The journals we reviewed feature stories of clinicians experiencing profound burnout while working in the public healthcare system. They describe trying to do deep trauma work in community clinics, only to find that systemic barriers, like their clients facing active homelessness or extreme poverty, made the clinical work feel impossible.
Because the system is just so broken.
Right. The sources note that building a solo, fee-for-service private practice is an effective way to insulate yourself from that specific type of systemic burnout. You get to control your environment, set firm boundaries, and charge a fee that actually sustains your life.
Which is completely valid.
But the source material also poses a challenging question for the profession as a whole. As you step away from the public system to create this protected environment, how will you define the success of your career?
That's a heavy question.
The journals point out that the clients who might need your specific radical help the absolute most are likely the ones who will be priced out of your new business model.
Yeah.
The sources ask us to consider, does private practice simply offer an escape hatch from a broken public system, or does it provide the personal stability and mental bandwidth necessary to eventually challenge and change that system from the outside?
It is a profound structural question to carry with you. When you are out there in the wilderness of British Columbia, navigating taxes, tech servers, and marketing, remember to periodically check that compass. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Take that first brave, calculated step toward your new business, and we will see you next time.